Last week we were looking at Daniel chapter 7. Daniel, of course, was a prophet. And in chapter 7, we read about a vision of Daniel, a vision given to him by God. And in that vision, God showed Daniel the whole sweep of human history, past, present, future. And the impact of that vision was devastating. It left Daniel completely shattered. In Daniel chapter 7, verse 28, Daniel says, "I was deeply troubled by my thoughts. My face turned pale." That was the impact Daniel's first vision had on him. Now, in chapter 8, we read about a second vision, which Daniel had 2 years later. A vision which leaves him even more traumatized. In this vision, he's no longer in Babylon. He's transported to Susa, which is one of the major cities in Persia. And in his vision, it seems to Daniel that he's sitting or he's standing by the Ulai Canal. Daniel looks up and he sees a strange series of events. In his dream, these events unfold in three stages. First, Daniel sees a ram with two long, dangerous-looking horns. One of the horns is longer than the other, but then the shorter one seems to sprout and grow longer than the first one. But both horns are pretty formidable. And this ram is pretty aggressive. As Daniel's watching, the ram charges off towards the west, and then he charges off to the north, and then he charges south, and he attacks every other animal he meets. And this ram is so powerful that he knocks down everything whose path crosses his. None of them can stand against him. He becomes lord and master of them all. Daniel says he did as he pleased. He became great. That's stage one of the vision. But then, stage two, Daniel sees another animal coming onto the scene. It's a goat. Now you've got to get the picture right at this point. You know, the moment we use the word goat, we get a picture in our mind. And the picture tends to be of rather a sort of silly, hopeless sort of creature. Our picture of goats has been shaped by nursery stories, hasn't it? Goats are creatures with long, silly beards who do silly things. They're creatures to be laughed at, the three billy goats gruff. But that's not the way goats were viewed in Bible times. They were seen as very dangerous animals. They had powerful horns. They could run high on the mountains, leaping from one crag to the next. You know, most creatures would be helpless up there, but a goat had this tremendous power of endurance. So goats were seen as splendid creatures. I mean, the book of Proverbs, you've got a list of things that are stately in their stride. Things that move with stately bearing. And the list starts with the lion. Mighty among beasts, he retreats before nothing. But the list also includes the he-goat. Leading his flock along with his head lifted high. Well, that's the way goats were viewed in the ancient world. They were formidable, splendid creatures. And this goat in Daniel's dream is particularly formidable. He's got one huge horn between his eyes. Of course, most goats have two horns. But with this goat, all its power has been concentrated in one single horn. And this goat appears from the west. You remember the ram in the first vision had established control north and south and east. But now from the west, this goat comes charging at tremendous speed. He's crossing the whole earth, and he's crossing it so fast that it looks as if he's flying. His feet never touch the ground. And he's filled with a terrifying rage. He slams into the ram. He attacks him furiously. He smashes the ram's horn. And then he tramples all over him. This goat is irresistible. The ram had been all-conquering. But this goat is 10 times more powerful than the ram had ever been. And Daniel says the goat became very great. Daniel recognizes that he's looking at a very special and awesome creature. This goat just becomes master of all he surveys, and he does it by his own incredible speed and force and drive and rage. But then, just as it seems that the goat has reached a point of total supremacy, when he's at the height of his power, the horn that he's used to win all his victories is snapped off without any obvious cause. Daniel doesn't say he got into a fight that was too much for him or anything like that. It just seems that suddenly the horn has been broken off. And in its place, 4 horns grow. They're quite big, but they're nothing like as big as the original horn. And 1 points north, and 1 horn points south, and 1 horn points east, and 1 horn points west. Daniel says they point towards the 4 winds of heaven. Now, of course, what that means is that they're nothing like as effective as fighting weapons. You know, you can see the picture, can't you, in your mind's eye? A single horn, like a spear. Well, that's a terrifying fighting weapon when the goat is moving at full pelt with that pointed straight at an opponent. Well, you've got something terrifying. But 4 horns all pointing in different directions, well, that means that the goat can't use its strength anything like as effectively now. It's still a formidable opponent, but it's not what it was. And then the vision moves on to another stage. Stage 3. As Daniel's watching, he sees a little horn growing out of one of those 4 horns. It's only little. It's insignificant. But it grows in power. And it begins to push towards the south. And it begins to push towards the east. And then it starts to push into the beautiful land. That's Daniel's name for the Holy Land, the land of Israel, the land that God had chosen for his own. And this little horn, this horn that sprouted from a horn that sprouted from a horn, this little horn carries on growing. And it carries on growing, and it carries on growing, until it reaches the sky. It's out of all proportion now to the size of the goat that it's mounted on. Imagine it, you've got a goat with 4 horns, and from one of those horns, a horn sprouting high enough to touch the heavens, and to start attacking the stars. That's what Daniel sees in his vision. He sees that little horn which has grown so big throwing some of the stars down to earth and trampling on them. And then it starts attacking God himself. Verse 11, it sets itself up to be as great as the Prince of the Host. That's to say, the Lord of the stars, the ruler of the heavens. And it seems to be winning in its war against God. It takes away the daily sacrifice from him. In the land of Israel, in the temple, sacrifice was offered daily to God. But this horn stops that from happening. And he says the place of the sanctuary was brought low. In the land of Israel, in Jerusalem, there stood the temple. And in the very heart of the temple was the sanctuary, the most holy place, God's dwelling place on earth. and this horn defiles the sanctuary. Daniel says this horn prospered in everything it did, and truth was thrown to the ground. This horn succeeds in overthrowing everything that's true. It overthrows true holiness and true faith and true worship. The true knowledge of God is all trampled underfoot. And then Daniel hears a voice speaking. And he knows, it's in verse 13, that it's the voice of one of God's holy ones. Doesn't identify it more exactly. It may be an angel, but it doesn't say so. But Daniel knows that this is a holy one speaking, someone who's close to God, and he's speaking to another holy one. Daniel's hearing a dialogue between two persons close to God, two persons who are there behind the scenes, who know what's going on. The first holy one asks the other the question, How long will this continue? How long will the sacrifice be stopped? How long will the little horn be attacking God? How long will he be in control of God's holy place and be allowed to trample it? How long will he be winning victories over the stars of heaven? And the other holy one answers, and he addresses his answer to Daniel, verse 14. He says it will take 2,300 evenings and mornings, a bit over 6 years, and then the sanctuary will be rescued from his grip. And again it will be reconsecrated, it will be set aside again as holy for God. Well, that was Daniel's vision. And Daniel says in verse 15, I was trying to understand it. It wasn't immediately clear to Daniel what it was all about. He found it baffling. And no wonder, it does seem baffling, doesn't it? But then, there before me, he says, stood one who looked like a man. And Daniel heard a man's voice calling. And what this voice said was, Gabriel, tell this man, tell Daniel, the meaning of the vision. Gabriel, one of God's angels. An angel whom God used at key points in Bible times to bring messages to human beings. Gabriel is given the job of explaining the vision to Daniel. Well, when Daniel knows that he's in the presence of Gabriel, and Daniel's terrified, he falls on his face. But Gabriel lifts him up and begins to explain the vision to him. He says, it's not about things that will happen in your lifetime, Daniel. It's about the times of the end, which is just Bible shorthand for saying something that has a place in God's long-term plan to save the world. And then Gabriel takes Daniel through the details of the vision. Now, some of the things that Gabriel tells Daniel, Daniel already knows, because they were there in his first vision, in chapter 7. But now they're spelled out in more detail. And Gabriel adds other things that are new to Daniel. Like we said, this is, again, a dream about the future. Not our future, but Daniel's future, or the future viewed from Daniel's standpoint. Remember, Daniel is living in the time of the Babylonian Empire. But that empire, the Babylonian Empire, is going to come to an end. And another empire is going to take its place. That's what the ram in Daniel's vision means. Gabriel explains to Daniel that it's a symbol of the empire of the Medes and Persians. That's verse 20. Babylon is going to fall, and the empire of the Medes and Persians, that two-horned empire, will take its place. And they'll conquer to the north and the south and the east. They'll seem undefeatable. That's what the first part of the vision was all about. The ram represents the empire of the Medes and Persians. But then, what about the goat from the west that attacks the ram at incredible speed and tramples it down? Well, verse 21, Gabriel says, the shaggy goat is the king of Greece. And the single horn, the large horn between his eyes, is the first king of Greece. But then, you remember that that big horn, that first horn, is broken off, and four horns grow in its place. What does that mean? Well, verse 22, it means that that first king will die, and that his empire will be split up into four kingdoms. Kingdoms in the north and the south and the east and the west, but none of them will be as powerful as he was. Well, let me just say at this point that all of this came exactly and precisely true. The Medes and the Persians did overthrow Babylon, and they did become irresistible. But eventually the Greeks, under Alexander, did come charging in from the west. And they did come at incredible speed. And they did smash the empire of the Medes and the Persians. Alexander was the first king of all Greece. He was the one who united Greece. And then he won an incredible series of victories over the Persians. And everywhere else that he went as well. It was 334 BC when Alexander won his first victory over the Persians. And he was only 22 then. And within 9 years, his empire stretched all the way to India. Alexander, you know, was amazing. He was a great strategist, supreme general, planning and carrying through those whirlwind campaigns. But he wasn't just that. He led from the front in every battle. He was heroic as a man. You know, if a city were to be attacked, he was always the first over the battlements. He didn't lead from the back. He led from the front all the time. And in battle, he was irresistible. But he wasn't just a crude butcher. Alexander had a huge vision to spread civilization. Everywhere he went, he built marvelous libraries and set up universities. His vision was to bring culture and civilization to the whole world. And he had huge personal charisma. Everybody who ever met Alexander was captivated by him. He was incredibly handsome. Everybody admitted that. And he was just brilliant. People called him Alexander the Great. People were still calling him Alexander the Great 1,000 years later. There was an evident greatness about Alexander. You know, in Daniel's vision, it was obvious that this goat with the wonderful single horn is great. And Alexander was great. And then just as Gabriel predicted, as the vision showed, Daniel died. That wonderful horn was snapped off. Okay. 33 years old when he died. And he didn't die in battle. Alexander died of a mysterious, unexplained illness. May have been brought on by a night of binge drinking. And just as Gabriel predicted, his empire was split up under four of his generals. It all worked out just as Daniel saw it in his vision, and just as Gabriel explained it. But we've not finished Gabriel's explanation yet. He went on to explain the little horn that grew from one of the four horns. Alexander's empire will split up into four kingdoms. And eventually, says Gabriel, from one of them, a stern-faced king, this is verse 23, a master of intrigue will arise, and he'll become very strong, but not by his own power, verse 24. He won't be a great soldier. He won't be a great general. He won't be a great anything, says Gabriel. He's just a master of intrigue. In other words, he's devious. He's crafty. He's manipulative. He's deceitful. It says in verse 25, he'll cause deceit to prosper. That's how he succeeds, just by lying and cheating. And he'll do awful damage. Well, Daniel's already seen in his vision what sort of damage this little horn will do. He'll attack the Holy Land. He'll stop the sacrifices. He'll defile God's own sanctuary. He'll persecute God's people. He'll even take his stand against the Prince of Princes. That's verse 25. He'll set himself up to oppose God. There'll be those 6 and a bit years when he's trampling God's name and God's temple and God's people underfoot. And yet, he'll be destroyed, says Gabriel. End of verse 25. But not by human power. And again, it all happened exactly as Gabriel said it would. It was hundreds of years after Daniel lived. Just before 170 BC, when Antiochus Epiphanes seized power over the land of Israel and slaughtered countless godly people, banned sacrifice to God, desecrated the temple, set himself up in the place of God, demanded that people should worship him. For 6 and a bit years, it seemed that God's honour and God's people were being trampled on by this evil, deceitful man. And then, just as Gabriel said, this man's life was cut short and his power was destroyed, though not by any human means. So that's Daniel's vision of the future. And that's how Gabriel explained it, and that's how it worked out. Now, I'm sorry, I know that all this detail seems 1,000 miles away from us. 1,000 miles away from our everyday concerns and from our struggles and our temptations and our hurts and our needs. You know, when you read this chapter, it all seems so far away from the gospel, so far away from the Saviour, so far away from all the things that we love to meditate on when we're together. But that's this chapter. It's here in God's word, and we've got to deal with it as it is, and we've got to think about it. So let's think about Daniel as he sees this vision, and then as he listens to this explanation. How does it affect him? Remember, his first vision in chapter 7 was traumatic. Well, this one was even worse. Verse 27, he was exhausted and he lay ill for several days. And the last sentence of the chapter, I was appalled by the vision. It was beyond understanding. Gabriel has explained what the vision means. But Daniel's still saying, it's beyond understanding. He's saying, I can't take it in. He's saying, this is just too bewildering. Daniel is made ill by the impact of this vision. It leaves his mind in a whirl. It leaves him feeling sick and drained, unable to do anything. So let's ask ourselves, what was it about this vision of the future that was so shattering, that was so utterly bewildering for Daniel? I'm going to suggest 4 things. The first thing is this: the fact that events here in this world seem so arbitrary. There seems so little sense, so little justice about the things that happen, and especially about who succeeds and who fails. You know, Daniel here in this vision is shown 2 men. two future rulers. First, there's Alexander, the great horn on the goat. And the thing that comes out is that he is truly great. Astonishingly talented and amazingly brave. And yet, just as he reaches the pinnacle of his power, he suddenly dies and it's all over. You know, at least if Alexander had lived, he would have been a genuinely great ruler. He'd have been an astonishing leader for the world. He really did believe in ideals of culture and civilization and education and science. And yet one night of stupid drinking and it's all over. That's Alexander on the one side. But then in contrast, you've got an Antiochus Epiphanes. And what Daniel sees is that there's nothing great about him. He's completely insignificant. The only thing he's good at is telling lies. He's a good liar, that's all. He's a master of intrigue. And yet he rises to this position of power where he's touching the heavens. And he's allowed to stay in that position of power for years. It is bewildering, isn't it? You know, I find it really depressing when I look at the world around me. And I see genuinely gifted, perhaps even great men who never achieve anything, who are sidelined, whose plans fail, who are completely talentless, useless idiots, and yet they get to the top just because they're devious and crooked, because they're skilled con men. You know, you can see it on the big scale, can't you? An art school reject. An out-of-work house painter called Hitler. Never been successful at anything in his life. But very good at lying and very good at manipulating people, becomes the most powerful man in the world. You know, the only way he could have come to power was the way that he did come to power. He would never have got through a university. He would never have got through a military college. But he becomes the most powerful man in the world just by conning people. And meanwhile, in Britain, a man like Churchill, with all his faults, was a great man, was sitting on the back benches in the Commons, ignored and sneered at by everybody. You see it on that big scale. But you know, some of you can see it in the company where you work. So sometimes you look at somebody in the school where you work or the company and you say, I just don't understand it. How did that man ever get into the position he's in? You look at somebody and he's completely incompetent, but he's good at working the system. He's good at flattering the right people. He's good at inventing fake CVs for himself. And meanwhile, people who are really gifted struggle at the bottom of the heap, never making progress. You see it in politics, don't you? You know, we wonder at times at some of the useless people who get to the top in politics in our time. People have got no record of achieving anything. They've just been professional politicians ever since they went to university. And they flattered the right people and they scratched the right backs. And now there they are sitting in the cabinet. There are times when you just wonder at it all. But you don't just wonder at it all, it's the injustice of it at times makes your blood boil. What's the biggest example of this in all history? Shall I tell you? It was when God's Son stood before a man called Herod. Jesus, the greatest man who ever lived, the bravest man, the wisest man, the best man who ever lived. man of towering gifts, teacher of genius, an orator beyond comparison, and a man with real power, awesome power, man who could still the storm with a word, man who could raise the dead, the man who was God's own son. And there he stands as a prisoner before Herod, King Herod, an effeminate playboy who's never done anything more strenuous in his life than watching dancing girls and getting drunk. Where's the justice in it? How is it that a man like Jesus can be treated as a criminal, while a man like Herod can be treated as a hero? Why is it that Jesus has to stand there being condescended to and patronized by a man like Herod? And then Jesus has to stand in front of a crooked politician like Caiaphas, and an incompetent civil servant like Pontius Pilate, who's desperately trying to salvage his career because he knows that the skids are under him. And men like these are in a position to sit in judgment on Jesus. It is bewildering, isn't it? If you can read through those accounts in the Gospels without a sense of bewilderment and anger, surely there's something wrong. Don't you feel angry at the sight of this man, Herod, looking at Jesus with a sneer on his face and saying, come on then, let's see you do a miracle for me. Doesn't it make you, your blood boil? The fact that there can be such injustice, that the man who's worthy to be worshipped by the angels can be treated like that? Oh, there's plenty of injustice in the world. There's plenty of great men who are sidelined, and there are plenty of wicked men who are put in positions of power, but never has it happened as acutely and horribly as it did when Jesus was hauled before Herod and Pilate and Caiaphas. 'Tis bewildering. A man like Simon Peter couldn't take it. He found it so bewildering that his faith just cracked. We're living in a world where there's no match between what a man is and what a man gets. And that's there in Daniel's vision. And then a second thing that Daniel must have found shattering: the fact that God's honour can be so trampled on. Daniel sees this evil man, Antiochus, this little insignificant, talentless creep, and he's attacking heaven. He's pushing the stars around. And when that's translated into action, into what's visible, what it means is that he's preventing God from being worshipped. He's issuing decrees, stopping sacrifice from being offered to God. He's turning God's holy temple into a pagan shrine where disgusting things are done. God's honour is being trampled into the ground. Now, to get the real force of this, you've got to remember that at the time Daniel was living, the temple had been destroyed. The land of Israel had been left desolate. The sacrifices had been stopped. But now, in the vision of the future, the land has been restored. It's the beautiful land again. And the temple has been rebuilt, and the sacrifices are being offered again. And then this man is allowed to ruin it all again. Just when it seems that God's honour has been restored, God's name, God's glory is trampled into the mud again. It doesn't just happen once, it happens again and again. What Daniel is seeing in his vision is horrible. The fact that we we live in a world where God can be so blasphemed, so insulted, where everything that's holy to God can be trampled on, where it can seem that God is defeated and powerless. Of course Daniel felt ill. I feel ill at times. When I'm sitting in the car on a journey, I turn on the radio and I hear how God's honour is trampled on. I hear comedians, talentless comedians, systematically laughing at God, sneering, sniggering at the God of the universe. Doesn't it make you feel ill when you know that the BBC broadcasts an opera in which Jesus is portrayed in a nappy, saying that he's a little bit gay? You know, I think if I had had to sit and watch the Jerry Springer opera right through, thank God I didn't. But I think I'd have reacted the same way that Daniel reacted. I'd have felt ill for days afterwards. Makes me ill now to think about it. Makes me shuddering. Daniel was seeing in his vision a horrible example of God blasphemed, of God robbed of his glory. Again, let me ask, what is the ultimate example of this in all history? There was a day when God's Son, the one who shone with all the glory of God, there was a day when he was taken out onto a hill outside Jerusalem. And he was humiliated. He wasn't even allowed a nappy. They stripped him and he hung naked between two criminals and men who weren't worthy to lick his feet stood and laughed at his agonies. Now, can we think about that and not be appalled? If we could glimpse what men did to God on that day, wouldn't we be left shattered? As Daniel was left shattered at the thought of God blasphemed. And then thirdly, Daniel was surely appalled by the fact that God's people can face such intense and such prolonged suffering here in this world. This little horn, told in verse 24, destroys the mighty men and the holy people, persecutes God's people savagely. And he does it not just for a day or for a week, but for 2,300 evenings and mornings. Don't. The angel could just have said, 6 years and a bit. But the people had to live through 2,300 mornings and 2,300 evenings of agony at the hands of this man, Antiochus. In Daniel's vision, God's people are back in their land. The exile is over. But now they're plunged into suffering again, and it's far more prolonged than anything they went through when the Babylonians attacked Jerusalem. Daniel watches God's people being trampled on, and he's appalled. It is appalling when you begin to find out what God's people have suffered down through the centuries. I tell you, it is appalling. In country after country, under one regime and then another, in prisons and in concentration camps and in psychiatric cells and in the arena and at the stake, what God's people have suffered does not bear thinking about. You know, just over a year ago, April 2007, three Turkish believers were tortured to death in Izmir. I began reading the account of what was done to them, and I had to lay it aside. I couldn't read it, because after the first couple of paragraphs, I was beginning to shake, and I was beginning to sweat, and I could feel my stomach begin to clench up. I was feeling too ill to carry on reading. I think if I had read it through, I think I'd have been like Daniel. I'd have been ill for days. The ladies in the ladies' meeting have been reading the story of Ann Judson, wife of the first pioneer missionary to Burma, Adoniram Judson. And I know that some of the ladies who have read that have just been left appalled by the sufferings that that Christian couple went through at the hands of men. Daniel, in his vision, saw these things happening. No wonder he was appalled. No wonder he was left shaken and ill. But again, let me ask you, if we are looking to see how intense and how fearful the sufferings of God's people can be, where is the greatest example? And again, we go to that hill outside Jerusalem, and we see the one man who deserves to be loved and cherished and delighted in by God and men. We see the Lord Jesus, and we see every bone of his body pulled out of joint, and we see his face blackened by thirst, and we see the signs of the beatings and the bruisings, and we see his back that's been laid open by the whip, and we hear him screaming, my God, why have you forsaken me? Yes, we look at the sufferings of God's people down through the centuries, and they're appalling. But this is the most appalling thing of all, that the innocent one, that Jesus, God's own son, should hang on a cross, tortured by men and abandoned by God his Father. And then the fourth thing, surely, that appalls Daniel as he sees events unfolding in this vision and as he hears Gabriel explain them. Surely the most appalling thing of all is this: the fact that all of this happens by God's plan, in God's plan, by God's will and decree. He's seen gross injustice. He's seen God's own name blasphemed. He's seen God's people suffering in the most appalling way. And he knows that it is in God's plan, that this is God's plan working itself out. You read in verse 12 that the host of the saints and the daily sacrifice were given over to this monstrous tyrant. The same word is used in verse 13, though it's disguised in the NIV, that the sanctuary is given over, the host is given over to be trampled underfoot. Daniel says, the angel says in verse 19, the vision concerns the appointed time. All this is unfolding by God's appointment, by God's preordained plan. Now do you see why Daniel says it's beyond understanding? That God should draw up such a plan, that God should ordain that worthless men should be allowed to control the empires of the world. That God should ordain that men should trample on his honour. That God should ordain that his people should suffer these appalling things. That this should be God's plan. Many Christians have been appalled when they've realized that. Many Christians have found that too much to take. The thought that God should really be in control of all things. That God should really ordain everything that comes to pass. That God should plan every event of history. Many Christians have struggled and said, I just can't accept that. I can't take it in. Daniel was appalled. And yet here it is written across the pages of the Bible that our God really is in control and that he really does plan all things according to the counsel of his own will. Do you find it appalling that God should allow a man like Hitler, a worthless man, to become the most powerful man in the world? That God should plan that? Do you find it appalling that God should allow his name and his honour to be trampled underfoot? Again and again in different places across the world and in our country. Do you find it appalling that God should plan that his people should suffer such unspeakable things? Do you find it appalling that God should have ordained Calvary? That God should have sent his own son to the cross? Do you find that appalling? That God should have planned for his son to be crucified, to be humiliated, to be broken, to be cast into the darkness? That the loving father should have planned for his son to scream out in agony and despair? Does that appall you? It appalls me. And yet, even while it appalls me, it fills my soul with a thought, with a wonder and an amazed joy, because I know that he did it for me. That he planned that because that was the price of redeeming me. I don't understand any more than Daniel understood. I'm as bewildered and, yes, as appalled as Daniel was appalled and bewildered. I don't understand God. I don't understand why God should value sinners so much as to hand his own son over to Calvary for them. I don't understand why he should exact that price. But he did. And it's for that that I worship him. And through all eternity, I'll be singing, you are worthy. You are worthy, O God. Because you did that. Because you did not spare your own son, but delivered him up. For God to deliver up his temple in Jerusalem was a little thing. For God to deliver up his own son, that is something beyond imagination, beyond words, and it was for us.